Content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is the Week Magazine. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the August 7th, 2026 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing this week, set on a beach. We see the Republican elephant. He is in a beach chair. Looks miserable. His face is red. His tongue's hanging out. Looks hot. He's wiping sweat off of his forehead. On the beach beside him are a couple of empty bottles of water and a sandy, crumpled MAGA hat. The headline is, A Long, Hot Summer. Can the GOP win back voters before the midterms? We'll catch that on the controversy of the week. Start with the first main story. More countries pulled into spiraling Iran war. What happened? The Iran war expanded further across the Middle East this week as Saudi Arabia joined the U.S. in striking Iran-backed militias in Iraq. Yemen's Iran-allied Houthi militant group hit Saudi tankers in the Red Sea, and a U.S.-owned natural gas storage tanker at an Egyptian port was set ablaze in a drone attack. In Riyadh's first acknowledged involvement in the conflict, Saudi and American fighter jets attacked the Iraq-based Popular Mobilization Forces, an umbrella group of Iraqi militants, in retaliation for more than 30 drone attacks on Saudi oil facilities, which the U.S. accused Iran of directing. The U.S.-Saudi operation, which killed at least 20 fighters, came hours after Iran launched a surprise ballistic missile attack at American military sites in Jordan, shattering a days-long pause in fighting. The missiles were all intercepted, but the assault marked a shift in strategy for Iran, showing it was willing to go on the offensive and not simply respond to U.S. strikes. After the drone strike at Egypt's Mediterranean port of Damietta, President Trump vowed to retaliate against Tehran, saying, It's our turn to hit them. In the southern Red Sea, the Houthis claimed at least four attacks on Saudi-linked tankers since announcing a maritime blockade of Saudi ports last week. Iran fired on three tankers it said were using an illegal route through the Strait of Hormuz, Saudi Arabia's other major shipping route, and reportedly rejected a proposal from Oman to divide control of the strait and solicit voluntary fees. Well, the columnist said, Iran's escalating attacks illustrate a fundamental shift in the war, said Jared Mousen and Suha Maia in the Wall Street Journal. The hardline Revolutionary Guard exerts more power than ever in Tehran and has grown more assertive and more comfortable with a state of war that could continue for months. It suits them better than a peace in which they'd have to confront public anger over Iran's struggling economy. Their zero-sum stance makes any agreement to end the war even more remote and heightens the risk of more frequent rounds of escalation. Trump has been told that a return to major combat operations would be a hugely risky endeavor, said Eric Schmidt and Jonathan Swan in the New York Times. At a meeting with cabinet members and top advisors last week, Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman General Dan Kane warned such an offensive would dangerously deplete the military's stockpile of air defense munitions. Trump and aides are also uneasy about a widening war alienating Gulf allies vulnerable to Iranian attack and a growing energy crisis. Sources say few, if any, in Trump's inner circle believed escalation was wise. That interceptor shortage could put American troops at more risk, said Ben Finley in the Associated Press. Our stockpile of Patriot interceptors has fallen from 2,330 before the war to as low as 759, according to the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And our stash of 452 THAAD interceptors has dropped by nearly 40%. To conserve inventories, the U.S. could take more risks, such as firing two rather than the standard three interceptors at incoming missiles. That might prove fatal for soldiers on the ground. Last month, three soldiers were killed in Jordan after an Iranian missile slipped through air defenses. Meanwhile, growing hostilities between Iran and Ukraine show the war's potential to go global, said Gideon Rockman in the Financial Times. Ukraine last week sank an Iranian vessel in the Caspian Sea. It said it was ferrying military cargo to Russia, drawing threats of retaliation from Tehran. Iran has supplied Russia with drones that have killed a great many Ukrainians. Ukraine says Russia, in turn, has given Iran intelligence to target American military assets. That Ukrainians are clashing directly with Iran is an ominous step toward a wider conflagration. Trump is in a bind, said Andrew Egger in the Bulwark. Through months of negotiation, Iran has offered a steady, ironclad position, insisting on an end to sanctions, no nuclear concessions, and control of the Strait of Hormuz. Our flailing president has toggled between two demonstrably failed positions. If we bomb the hell out of them, they'll give us what we want. If we stop bombing them, they'll give us what we want. While he vacillates in the vain search for an exit strategy, the damage mounts. Petroleum reserves, missile stockpiles, global trust in the U.S.-led world order. These are finite resources that are all being spent down at alarming rates. And a shorter main story. Haitians brace for immigration crackdown. What happened? More than 330,000 Haitian migrants were set to lose their ability to legally live and work in the U.S. this week, clearing the way for the Trump administration to conduct mass immigration raids in their communities and ramp up deportations to gang violence-plagued Haiti. As the week went to press, a Supreme Court ruling that allows the White House to end temporary protected status for Haitians and 6,000 Syrians was poised to come into effect. With the Department of Homeland Security warning that TPS recipients' free trial of America has ended. Fox News reported that Immigration and Customs Enforcement was preparing to target the affected migrants in places like Springfield, Ohio, home to a large Haitian community that President Trump baselessly claimed during his 2024 presidential campaign had been eating cats and dogs. One Haitian woman who works as a nurse in Florida and is a mother to a U.S.-born toddler told the New York Times that her anxiety is indescribable. Meanwhile, the Trump administration is ramping up its immigration crackdown at U.S. airports. While ICE has been working with the Transportation Security Administration since last year to detain travelers with deportation orders, recent operations have also targeted people who have overstayed visas, including migrants seeking residency through their American spouses and those with active asylum claims. You're talking about people with legitimate pending applications, said Ghassan Shami, an immigration lawyer, not people with criminal records. What the columnist said. Haitians and Syrians living in the U.S. with TPS have been in panic mode since the Supreme Court's decision, said Janice Armstrong in the Philadelphia Inquirer. We're not talking about illegal aliens. They own homes, have jobs, pay taxes. Now what are they supposed to do? Where do they go? And do they take their American-born children with them? Kicking Haitians out will also hurt the economy, said Jacqueline Charles in the Miami Herald. Ohio Governor Mike DeWine, a Republican and longtime supporter of Haiti's causes, noted that Haitians fill many essential jobs, including the health care sector. About 70% of Haitian people who have TPS are employed, said Gisela Salomon and Matt Sadinsky in the Associated Press, which means the labor force just lost roughly 230,000 people overnight. After work authorization for his Haitian cooks and busboys ended this week, one Key West, Florida restaurateur was worried about whether he has enough staff to operate. The Trump administration is driving Haitians into an active war zone, said retired Lieutenant General Russell L. Honore in the New York Times. Haiti, an island nation dominated by armed gangs, is on the verge of total state collapse. The White House knows that it's incredibly dangerous. If it didn't, it wouldn't maintain a level 4 do not travel advisory for the country. Forcing hundreds of thousands of people there will only worsen the humanitarian crisis and feed the chaos. And the controversy of the week, midterms. Will a summer of campaigning save the Republicans? Members of Congress are leaving Washington for their summer recess, said Kaylin Razor in Politico, but the break will be anything but relaxing for GOP lawmakers. With less than 100 days left before the midterm elections, and with Democratic candidates up by an average of 6.1 percentage points in the generic ballot, Republicans must now spend five anxious and potentially grueling weeks at home in their districts. They'll try to somehow persuade voters not to punish them in November for the high cost of living, an unpopular war in Iran, and the failures and excesses of President Trump, whose approval rating has flatlined below 40%, and who is loudly and regularly attacking Senate Republicans for failing to pass his Save America Act package of voting restrictions. Parties in power usually lose seats in the midterm, said Liz Goodwin and Ben Bende in the Washington Post. And November was going to be a tough no matter what for Republicans, giving Trump's sagging poll numbers. But with the Iran war heating up again, pushing gas prices back above $4, some GOP pollsters are raising the alarm about the widening enthusiasm gap between the two parties' voters. While Democrats are champing at the bit, Republicans are listless and demotivated, with about 1 in 5 reliable Republican base voters saying they may stay home on Election Day or even vote Democrat. Republicans should be doomed, said Chris Stein in The Guardian, but Democrats have their own woes. For starters, the party is broke. While the Republican National Committee has nearly $130 million in cash, most of it from wealthy donors, the Democratic National Committee is $2 million in debt. If the midterms were held today, Democrats would be favored to at least win back the House, said Julia Mueller in The Hill. The latest forecast from Decision Desk HQ suggests they'll win a 15-seat advantage in the chamber and send House Speaker Mike Johnson's caucus back into the minority. But that's down 10 seats from early July, and it doesn't help the Democrats are now attacking one another in a bitter public argument over the party's future. That debate has been a gift to Republicans, said Mona Shirin in The Bulwark. Earlier this year, the GOP had nothing to run on and seemed headed for a deserved drubbing in November. But candidates aligned with the Democratic Socialists of America then scored a succession of Democratic primary wins in New York and Colorado. The DSA's platform calls for abolishing prisons, borders, and the presidency, while pushing sky-high taxes to fund a workers' paradise of free everything, a set of policies seemingly designed to repel swing voters. The DSA's rise has given the GOP its midterm message, said Ed Kilgore in New York. Republicans can and will now frame the midterms as a vast ideological struggle against radical socialism, with Trump and the GOP, for all their flaws, as the safer bet. Much may hinge on the final wild card of the season, said Hans Nichols in Axios. Michigan's August 4th Senate Democratic primary between centrist Representative Haley Stevens and progressive insurgent Abdul El Sayed, a leftist Muslim with a habit of equivocating about terrorism, may not be able to win in a Midwest swing state, said Nick Cottagio in the Dispatch. But will this new red scare really make the electorate as a whole forget 21 months of rising prices, ICE killings, weaponized government, and a lascivious corruption? Socialism may be an albatross around the Democrats' necks, but it's likely less of one than Trump is for Republicans. Here's a good week, bad week piece. It was a good week for thrift, after a hiker who accidentally impaled himself through the torso with a trekking pole near the summit of Montana's 12,800-foot granite peak, spent 6 hours descending the mountain rather than spring for a pricey helicopter rescue. "I knew it wasn't deep," shrugged David Cifaldi, 32, a wound nurse at the hospital in Billings, Montana. It's a good week for aging Lotharios. After scientists discovered that sildenafil, the active ingredient in Viagra, may help slow the spread of cancer. The effect was observed in a lab, but an analysis of health records also found an association between Viagra use and higher survival rates for some cancers. It's a good week for daddy issues. After President Trump told an audience of Michigan auto workers that "I've done more for you than your parents," Trump clarified that "your parents are good. I'm not going to knock your parents, but I have been better to you than your parents." But it was a bad week for the diarrhea diet after U.S. medical professionals warned the public not to follow the advice spreading online that they can get cyclospora skinny by eating lettuce tainted with the intestinal parasite. Getting any kind of illness to purposely cause something like that is just a bad idea, said Arizona physician Andrew Carroll. It's a bad week for superheroes after Disney-owned animation studio Pixar announced the layoff of 108 employees in a document that included an image of Mrs. Incredible, a.k.a. Elastigirl, in the letterhead. Finally, it was a bad week for cold feet. After the arrest for arson of a Utah bride-to-be, who was on the eve of her wedding, allegedly set fire to the church where she was set to marry. Lenita Moreno, 25, was also charged with retail theft because the lighter used to start the fire was allegedly shoplifted from a hardware store. Time for the briefing. Cutting the food safety net. Republicans tightened access to SNAP benefits. Millions more Americans are now going hungry. How big a problem is hunger in the U.S.? The nonpartisan Urban Institute reports that nearly 1 in 4 adults last year experienced household food insecurity, defined as not having enough to eat or knowing where the next meal may come from. That's up from 1 in 5 in 2020. The Trump administration stopped collecting data on food insecurity in 2025, saying the information was used to fearmonger. For nearly 40 million low-income Americans, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, commonly known as food stamps, serves as a lifeline. The 62-year-old program gives recipients an average of $187 a month to spend on groceries. Qualifying households must have an annual income below 130% of the poverty line, which this year is $15,960 for a single person and $38,680 for a family of five. Nearly 80% of households receiving SNAP benefits have members who are over 60, disabled, or under 18. But more than 4 million people, including at least 776,000 children, have been dropped from the program's rolls over the past year, largely because of changes to SNAP included in the One Big Beautiful Bill, the OBBB, passed by the Republican-led Congress last summer. With grocery prices up nearly a third since 2020, a growing number of Americans are now struggling to put food on the table. "I go to sleep thinking about what we're going to eat," said Dee McDonald, a 65-year-old cancer survivor raising 3 grandsons in Mesa, Arizona, and who last year lost her SNAP benefits. "I'm exhausted." What did the OBBB do? To reduce SNAP's costs by $187 billion over the next decade, the package tightened eligibility requirements and shifted more financial responsibility to state governments. States became responsible for 75% of SNAP's administrative costs, up from 50%. The OBBB also mandated states cover up to 15% of SNAP benefits if their error rate, mistakes that lead to under or overpayment of benefits, exceeds 6%. Error rates nationally sit above 10%, and only 9 states are below that threshold. Those above will face billions of dollars in new costs unless they can bring their error rates down. The OBBB also removed work exemptions from groups including adults ages 54 to 64, veterans, and parents of teenagers, all of whom must now prove they spend at least 20 hours a week working or volunteering to get benefits. Refugees were made almost completely ineligible. What's the justification for those cuts? The Republicans who passed the OBBB say the program had become bloated and strayed from its goal of helping society's most vulnerable. They also saw SNAP cuts as a means to finance the law's tax reductions. SNAP has expanded substantially in recent years. The number of recipients has more than doubled since the early 2000s, and the Biden administration lifted average benefits by more than 25% during the pandemic. Agriculture Secretary Brooke Rollins said the recent drop in SNAP enrollees is a result of a better economy, which means people don't need food stamps, and measures in the OBB that removed fraudulent claimants. Is there much fraud in the program? While error rates seem high, that's mostly due to unintentional mistakes, often made by caseworkers, in calculating how much an applicant should receive based on their income and expenses. And most recipients are not avoiding work to claim benefits. 89% of SNAP households with children and a working age non-disabled adult have at least one working member. But the OBBB is making it harder for them to get SNAP. States are scrambling to find ways to lower error rates, more paperwork to prove eligibility, phone interviews, and AI-run wage checks. That extra workload is swamping state SNAP agencies, many of which were already understaffed. In Massachusetts, over 80% of calls to the agency that administers SNAP are now being dropped. Disconnections happen automatically when there aren't enough agents to answer. Arizona has dropped nearly half of all state SNAP recipients, including Tiffany Hudson. A single mother of two has been receiving $600 a month in food assistance to supplement her earnings as a part-time caretaker. After her benefits were cut off, she was told to provide more documentation, including a written statement that a monetary birthday gift from her father was not a recurring payment. "We've been going to food banks every week," Hudson said. "We're eating less." Can charities make up the difference? They're trying amid a surge in demand. A New York Fed report in February revealed that nearly 16% of Americans now rely at least partly on donated food. "Sometimes people are sitting in a 2 to 3 mile line the night before a distribution starts," said Amy Brightman, director of a food bank in Augusta, Georgia. Beth Fiorenza's food bank in Phoenix has been receiving more than 200 people a day, up from 150 to 175, about 40% of them newcomers. "Charities do not have the capacity to make up for the shortfall," said Harvard Health Policy Professor Sarah Blyke. "For every meal that food banks provide, SNAP provides 9. Are there more changes ahead? An appropriations bill recently passed by the House would cut $141 million for fruit and vegetable benefits from the Special Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women, Infants, and Children, or WIC. The program, in which nearly 5.4 million children and pregnant and postpartum women are enrolled, has historically enjoyed bipartisan support. And the bill's Republican backers argue the cuts won't limit access. But Trump's own 2027 budget proposal, submitted in April, would reduce WIC's monthly fruit and vegetable allowance for children under 5 from $26 to $10. "They just don't care what they're cutting," said Mariah Hamilton, 35, a Philadelphia area mother who receives WIC for her infant son and is struggling with rising food costs. How much more do you think I can bear? Time for a few of the best columns. First two come from the U.S. A legal way to steal the midterms. Could Donald Trump and Republicans exploit a legal loophole to steal the midterm elections? Asked David French. Unfortunately, the answer is yes. Article 1, Section 5 of the Constitution says that each house shall be the judge of the elections, returns, and qualifications of its own members. This means the House and Senate decide who is seated in their respective chambers, and ominously, those decisions are not reviewable by any other branch of government, including the courts. Under election law, losing House candidates can contest their defeats, and the Republican majority can decide by a simple vote to seat them, even if their challenge lacks evidence of fraud or error. Trump has created multiple pretexts to declare Democratic victories in November invalid. When he inevitably does, House Speaker Mike Johnson and other Republican leaders won't defy him the way Vice President Mike Pence did in 2020. If you think such a scenario is too far-fetched to be real, it's happened several times in American history, including in 1931, when House Democrats reversed a Republican's narrow victory. If control of the House comes down to a few seats, we should be under no illusions about MAGA's intentions. The Saudis turn to be betrayed. Saudi Arabia has just learned a hard lesson about Donald Trump, said David Frum. Even showering billions on him and his family does not mean he won't betray you. For a single day last week, it appeared that the Saudis scored a breakthrough they've long sought when they signed an agreement with U.S. Energy Secretary Chris Wright that allows American companies to build nuclear power plants on Saudi soil. Such a deal might open a path to uranium enrichment and an eventual Saudi nuclear weapon. The petrostate's ruling elite must have seen the nuclear agreement as payoff for the billions they invested in the Trump Organization and son-in-law Jared Kushner's private equity firm. But within 24 hours, Trump posted that the deal was totally subject to Saudi Arabia joining the Abraham Accords, his 2020 initiative to normalize relations between the Arab world and Israel. The shocked Saudis said they intended to do no such thing. Did Trump intentionally blow up the deal after it received strong criticism from Republicans? No one knows, but it's more proof that no nation or person can trust any promise made by a president this faithless, chaotic, and corrupt. This column comes from India. After decades of moral panic and dithering, India may finally be ready to allow sex ed in schools, said Namita Bandre. In a remarkable and welcome development, the government of Prime Minister Narendra Modi and his Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party has signed off on a sex ed curriculum, and now we're just waiting for the Supreme Court to approve it. It's high time. Last time we tried this, nearly 20 years ago, BJP lawmakers refused to adopt the program experts had recommended, saying it went against Hindu culture and would corrupt young minds. Their intransigence was manifestly ridiculous. Where do these custodians think the Kama Sutra originated? Silence about sex has never protected young people. It just makes them turn to the internet for answers where they absorb toxic, regressive views. What Indian youth need is an environment where body parts can be named without shame, and teachers and parents become resources rather than threats. They need frank conversations about consent and how to reconcile their desires with their values. Conservatives needn't worry. The lessons will take up only 15 minutes twice a week, so it's not as if students will be getting how-to manuals. If we can shed our stereotypes about relations between the sexes, maybe we'll end up with a more respectful, egalitarian society. A quick note, I somehow forgot to unpause the record button, and I am going back to where I think I stopped. Apologies if there was a gap in the recording or if you've heard part of this already. The last word, fleeing the Hermit Kingdom. After more than a decade of planning, a North Korean family made a daring escape to South Korea, said Choi Sang-hoon in the New York Times. Could they adapt to life in their new home? Seoul, South Korea. Rain lashed a flimsy wooden boat as it tossed through a churning sea, its engine straining against the swell. Under the cover of a stormy night 3 years ago, the vessel was fleeing North Korea. On board were nine people, including two small children and a woman who was 6 months pregnant. Only a couple of the passengers had seafaring experience. They eluded a patrol ship speeding across the world's most heavily guarded maritime border. Soon after their boat lurched into South Korean waters, a high-speed warship of the South's Navy bore down on it, tearing the water in aggressive circles. Snipers on the vessel trained their laser sights on the chest of the three adult men on the wooden boat. Through a loudspeaker, a voice boomed, "Are you lost? Engine trouble?" The North Korean shouted, "Please help. We are defecting." The red dots remained stubbornly fixed on their chest. The South Koreans were taking no chances. The three men were clad in North Korean military uniforms, camouflage for a high-stakes escape. Desperate, the men shouted into the boat's cramped hold for the other passengers to emerge to prove that they were civilians. From below, the two children, a 5-year-old girl and 3-year-old boy, were hauled up first, both pale and wasted from seasickness. Only then did the red dots drop off. The North Koreans, led by Kim Il-hyuk and his younger brother, Yi-hyuk, were bound together by blood and marriage. The brothers, both in their 30s at the time, were accompanied by their mothers and their families, Il-hyuk's partner, who was pregnant, and Yi-hyuk's wife, their two children, his mother-in-law, and his brother-in-law. The family, who defected in 2023, were among the few who managed to escape North Korea after its leader, Kim Jong-un, imposed a crushing lockdown during the coronavirus pandemic. They arrived in their adopted country with rare insights into a nation that had been choked off from the outside world. Some details of their escape have not been previously reported. "That night," said Yi-hyuk's wife, Yu-mi, "we crossed from a sea of darkness to a sea of freedom." The brothers came from Pyeongsong, a county in North Korea's southwest. During the famine of the late 1990s, their father, a railway security official, returned with grim accounts from the hardest-hit provinces. The emaciated bodies of children found outside train stations were frozen solid, thumping like frozen fish when they were tossed into trucks headed to burial grounds. He was the first in the family to lose faith in a ruling class that was unable to feed its people. One night after his sons reached adulthood, he took them to a hill and pointed toward a cluster of lights across the South Korean border. "That's where we should go," he said, "to live and stand tall." Yu-mi lived in the nearby coastal town of Kaegyeong. From there, she could see planes glinting in the sun as they rose from Incheon International Airport, just across the water, a shimmering vision of possibility yet unreachable for North Koreans, barred from travel and cut off from the internet. "Our country felt like a prison without bars," she said. Beginning in kindergarten, children sang the anthem, "We Have Nothing to Envy," even as they were mobilized to haul river water or scour hills for herbs and pine nuts. After long work days, adults attended compulsory life review sessions, writing self-criticism and pledges of loyalty. When Kim Jong-un visited an island near Yumi's town in 2013, soldiers and villagers swarmed into the sea in jubilation. She knew the scene was staged. Ordinary residents, she said, had been banned from leaving home. In the face of the propaganda, a contraband culture spread. South Korean films and dramas circulated on USB drives smuggled from China. In Kaegurong, the devices also arrived inside plastic bottles released by South Korean activists across the water, along with rice and many Bibles. Officials warned the bottles contained poison, but South Korean entertainment was winning. Il-hyuk idolized K-pop groups like Girls' Generation and styled his hair in a mohawk like Big Bang's Taeyang. He was arrested for capitalist delinquency and released only after paying a bribe, his hair razored. He and his friends once secretly watched Valkyrie, the Tom Cruise film about the plot to kill Adolf Hitler. When the conspirators failed and were executed, his friends wept. The brothers' notion of deserting North Korea felt just as perilous. Their father forbade them from marrying, reasoning that the larger the family, the greater the risk of being caught while defecting. He then used connections to transfer Yi-hyuk, his youngest, to Kaegurong, where he learned navigation, mapped guard posts, and cultivated ties with officials. Yi-hyuk became a helmet diver who harvests seafood from the ocean floor, breathing fresh air piped through a surface hose. He eventually met Yu-mi. Il-hyuk worked in North Korea's shadow economy, bribing his way into opportunity and out of trouble. He butchered animals for restaurants, ran a small gold mine, and bought and sold rice stolen from state granaries. He also grew disillusioned with the system he was gaming. Then, in 2014, their father died unexpectedly. The South Korean dream seemed to die with him. Where Il-hyuk, the older brother, was restless, Yi-hyuk was steady. He married Yu-mi in 2017, and the couple soon had their two children. He joined a military-run fisheries company, operating three vessels. Despite a United Nations ban, Chinese buyers worked openly in Kaegurong, and on a good day, Yi-hyuk could earn more than a typical worker's annual salary. Il-hyuk began dating a kindergarten teacher. Defection was no longer a priority. When I mentioned it, my brother told me to watch my mouth, Il-hyuk recalled. The pandemic overturned everything. North Korea imposed one of the world's harshest lockdowns. In Kaegurong, access to the sea was closed off with barbed wire and armed guards. Yi-hyuk's boats rusted and his debts mounted. Officials claimed that South Korea was dumping infected bodies and waste into border waters. Yet boats supplying the seafood to the top tiers of society continued to fish. The elites still ate whatever they wanted, Yu-mi said. Public executions grew more frequent, targeting those accused of committing violent crimes like murder, which surged during the lockdown, or of distributing non-socialist content such as South Korean dramas. Thousands, including the brothers, were forced to watch as rifle fire cracked across the execution grounds. The crowds dispersed in silence. The goal was to instill fear, Il-hyuk said, to erase any fantasy about the outside world. The brothers no longer argued about whether to leave, only how. By early 2023, North Korea had begun easing its pandemic restrictions. Yi-hyuk's boats were among the first permitted back to sea. But the window to escape was already closing. Authorities were preparing to install cameras along the coast to deter defections. The brothers spoke in code over the phone. Good weather meant a storm was coming, forcing patrol boats back to port. We've got a good catch. Come down here meant Il-hyuk should bring their mother and his girlfriend to Kaegurong. The weather and the catch were ideal on May 6, 2023. Yu-mi's mother, a 52-year-old widow, signed up last, 5 hours before departure. I could die trying to escape, she said, but if my family reached the south and I stayed behind, I'd be as good as dead anyway. The relative of traitors. Yi-hyuk's brother-in-law, his fishing partner, slipped away by boat and waded offshore. The rest of the family crossed a coastal hill strewn with landmines to reach a secluded beach. to carry Yehuk's two young children more easily, the brothers sealed them inside burlap sacks and hoisted them onto their shoulders. Before they closed the sacks, Yumi caught her children looking up at her. "I thought it might be the last time I'd ever see them," she said. I cried, and my husband teared up too. Yehuk's brother-in-law spotted the prearranged signal, flashlight blinking three times from the beach, and steered the boat in to pick up the rest of the extended family. Around 10 p.m., the 30-foot-long vessel pulled away, its engine throttled down to little more than a brisk walking pace as it tried to slip quietly toward Yeonpyeong Island in South Korea, just 9 miles away. Below deck, Yumi suddenly felt the engine roar to full throttle, filling the hold with exhaust and leaving the women and children seasick. Her youngest child's eyes rolled back. She carried him up for fresh air and found the men on deck in a panic. "That's when I saw a searchlight from a North Korean patrol boat sweeping across the waves behind us," she said. "My heart dropped." The brothers had already agreed on what to do if they couldn't outrun a security vessel, strap life jackets and flashlights onto the women and children, and send them into the sea, trusting the current to carry them south. The men would steer the boat away as a decoy, making a last stand with 20-inch knives and homemade red pepper bombs. To lighten the boat, Ilhyuk threw anything heavy overboard. Axes, wrenches, a fishing net, his brother's air compressor for helmet diving. Gradually, the searchlight behind them faded. The brothers later speculated that the fishing net they had thrown overboard had tangled in the pursuing boat's propeller. Their two-hour gamble ended shortly after midnight, after the South Korean vessel stopped them and all 9 family members were brought on board. An officer greeted them. "Welcome to paradise." In the South, Yumi studied to gain an accounting clerk certificate and found work at a school. Her brother enrolled in college while Yehyuk returned to helmet diving for seafood. "My brother joked the diving gear here was so advanced he could fall asleep underwater if he wanted to," Yehyuk recalled. Ilhyuk's girlfriend gave birth to their first child in the South. The couple married in 2024 and soon welcomed another daughter. Ilhyuk is finding his footing in the South's capitalist economy, trying part-time jobs at restaurants and operating forklifts and excavators. The plunge into the South's noisy democracy was overwhelming. TVs offered endless channels, so different from the North, where only government broadcast existed. Back home, Ilhyuk's used motorbike was a prized status symbol. Now he found himself on highways crowded with modern cars. City squares rang with protest. Yumi's mother marveled at faucets that produced both hot and cold water. On her first day working at a nursing home, she faltered when colleagues asked her for napkins, another English word she'd never heard. The brother's mother was scandalized by a TV drama in which a wife slapped her husband. And when Ilhyuk first ventured beyond Seoul, he dutifully called a police detective to ask for permission. The detective only laughed. And then there were elections. In the North, people lined up in formal dress to receive a ballot with only one name. They placed their vote in the yes box with both hands and bowed deeply to the portraits of Kim Jong-un's father and grandfather, who ruled before him. No one dared approach the no box. When Ilhyuk and his wife voted in June as South Korean citizens, they found voters arriving in shorts and slippers, earphones in place. The ballot was a bewildering list of names. Yet South Korea was no paradise. After 19 months in the South, Yehyuk died in a diving accident in late 2024. The brother's mother and Ilhyuk's wife were diagnosed with cancer. Ilhyuk vented frustration at Seoul's soaring housing prices. He is saving every penny to move his family out of the cramped, government-subsidized rental apartment. Still, he insisted the defection was 100% the right choice. Before his death, Yehyuk appeared on television, explaining that he fled to spare his children the indoctrination of North Korean schools. His daughter is now a second grader at a South Korean school, and his son is in kindergarten. The children adapted fastest to their new lives, quickly embracing South Korean staples like fried chicken and pizza. My husband gave me and our children the freedom he promised before he died, Yumi said. The brothers also honored their father's final wish. When their boat fled North Korea, they carried his ashes with them. This article originally appeared in the New York Times. Here's a couple of health and science short pieces. A scary milestone for measles. The U.S. measles outbreak just set a horrifying new record. The CDC puts the count so far this year at more than 2,300 as of mid-July, edging past the record total for all of 2025 and making this the worst year since the disease was declared eliminated from the country in 2000. In fact, more measles cases have been reported in just the last 2 years than in all the years from 2000 through 2024 added together. Big clusters in South Carolina and Utah drove much of the surge, and health officials in some states now fear their outbreaks may never be fully snuffed out. Measles is ferociously infectious, with a single case capable of seeding 18 more, and its dangers don't end when the rash fades. The virus can smolder in the brain for years before triggering a rare complication that is almost always fatal. More than 90% of infections have been in people who were unvaccinated or whose status was unknown. Yet only about a fifth of the cases have involved children under 5. Roughly half were ages 5 to 19, and 30% were adults. That tells us this has been years of under vaccination in some communities. William Moss, an epidemiologist at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, tells the Washington Post, "This has been years in the making. It's not just the result of one outbreak." The drug that beats statins. Cheap and reliable statins are taken by tens of millions of Americans, but they can push bad LDL cholesterol down only so far. Now the FDA has approved a daily pill that goes considerably further. Enlicitide, sold under the brand name Lipfendra, blocks a protein called PCSK9 to get LDL numbers under 60 milligrams per deciliter, and sometimes under 50. Adults not on medication normally have levels above 100, but new guidelines say those high risk of heart attack should aim for a level under 55. There are injectable drugs that work on the same protein, but barely 1% of the 6 million Americans who qualify for the shots actually get them. That's likely because the injection regimen costs up to $600 a month and generally isn't covered by insurance. For such patients, Lipfendra could be a cheaper, easier alternative. In a 24-week trial of nearly 3,000 people, Lipfendra lowered LDL by as much as 60%, and a month's supply runs $315. This is an incredible breakthrough in heart disease prevention and care, cardiologist Mohamed Elo tells Forbes. And we're on the Talking Points page. Iran war. Are U.S. casualties being covered up? The Trump administration has found a novel way to limit the U.S. death toll in the Iran war, said Jack Crosby in Rolling Stone. Claim that some deaths don't count. Last week, the names of 4 service members killed by Iranian strikes in mid-July suddenly vanished from the Pentagon's official list of war dead, lowering the total from 18 to 14. U.S. officials gave differing explanations for the change, from benign temporary data disruptions to the claim that the troops killed in Jordan and Iraq didn't actually die in the war with Iran, since Operation Epic Fury technically stopped when President Trump struck a temporary ceasefire with Tehran in April. Never mind that neither side ever ceased firing. After Senate Democrats and veteran groups protested the disappearance, the names of the 4 service members reappeared on the Pentagon website, but under a different category for overseas operations, which includes only those killed and injured since July 7th, when fighting fully reignited. This is only the latest attempt by the administration to obscure the human cost of its unpopular war, said Edith Olmstead in the New Republic. In March, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth dismissed an Iranian drone strike on a tactical operations center in Kuwait as a squirter, and the Pentagon said just five troops were seriously wounded. In fact, dozens of soldiers suffered injuries including burns, shrapnel wounds, and brain trauma. And when the Pentagon restored the four dead soldiers to its online database, it also quietly upped the number of wounded personnel by more than 140, pushing total U.S. casualties in the war above 600. Trump last week tried to put a positive spin on the casualty account, said Joe Lancaster in Reason, favorably comparing it to an online post, the conflict's 4 months, 18 dead, with thousands of Americans killed in the multi-year wars in Korea, Vietnam, Iraq, and Afghanistan. That may be true, but American soldiers are still dead as a direct result of the conflict he helped instigate. This is predictable behavior from Trump, said David A. Graham in The Atlantic. He has frequently treated the military as a political prop, and according to his first-term chief of staff, John Kelly, called U.S. troops who died in wars suckers and losers. Trump and Hegseth seem to think that American public are suckers as well, and thought their accounting tricks would prevent Iran war deaths from becoming a political liability. But that plan backfired and has succeeded only in drawing attention to the 18 dead Americans. The administration sought to hide the war in Iran. Instead, it showed the painful and growing costs. Peptides. The FDA opens a Pandora's box. America is about to go over a peptide cliff, said Tom Bartlett in The Atlantic. An FDA advisory panel voted last week to recommend that six unproven peptides be added to the list of custom drugs that so-called compounding pharmacies can sell. Peptides are chains of amino acids that tell cells to regulate biological processes. Some peptides, including insulin and GLP-1s, are FDA-approved medicines. But pharmacies were banned in 2023 from dispensing these six peptides, which adherents claimed deliver benefits ranging from improved endurance to reduced inflammation, over efficacy and safety concerns. That annoyed Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., a peptides fan, who added eight new members to the panel ahead of the vote, six of whom run clinics that offer the chemicals. The vote is only a recommendation, but ultimate approval seems likely, to the glee of sellers anticipating a peptide gold rush and the horror of experts who fear we're opening a Pandora's box. Demand for injectable peptides is surging thanks to the endorsement of podcasters, wellness influencers, and celebrities, said Emily Mullen in Wired. Among the chemicals that got the nod from the panel are two that combined to make the Joe Rogan-backed Wolverine stack, which supposedly aids in injury recovery. Undaunted by the lack of evidence that they work, users currently buy peptides on the unregulated gray market. The chemicals are sourced from labs in China and India and sold as for research use only. The vote exposed a deep divide between Kennedy's appointees and FDA scientists, said Jonathan Daniel in ABCNews.com. The latter cited the absence of clinical trial data and the possibility of harmful immune reactions. But the proponents argued thousands of people already take potentially dangerous black market peptides and that the agency should protect them by granting access to safer product. This isn't just about peptides, said Julia Belous in the New York Times. It's part of a broader push to increase access to drugs that haven't met the strict evidence standards the FDA usually requires. The agency wasn't designed for this wellness-crazed telehealth era in which Americans are going outside the bounds of traditional health care in growing numbers. But the FDA is the only thing standing between consumers and a Wild West market for untested and potentially harmful drugs. There has to be a better way forward than dropping standards and allowing consumer demand to override scientific evidence. And a few of the shorter notes. Nearly a dozen gun stores that had their license revoked by the Biden administration to sell guns received permission to sell again under President Trump. Two of the shops had together sold at least 175 guns that were recovered at crime scenes from 2021 to 2024. The number of children under 18 living in large U.S. cities has dropped 6% over the past decade, compared with a 1% drop in that demographic nationwide. The number of children under age 5 in cities fell 15% compared with a 7% drop nationwide. Families cite high cost, safety, and quality of life as reasons for leaving cities. After a year-long legal fight, the Trump administration has dropped its subpoena for a list of Jewish people employed by the University of Pennsylvania. The administration said the information would be used to identify potential victims of alleged acts of campus anti-Semitism. UPenn officials and Jewish groups compared the subpoena to the list of Jews compiled by the Nazis. And let's see, we will finish out today's show with a quote from Viktor Frankl, quoted in the Jerusalem Post, who says, "Everything can be taken from a person, but one thing, to choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. Hope you've enjoyed it. Please join us again next time. This is Fred Woodward, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The Week magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. The number again is 919-832-5138. And as always, we thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.